Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Good evening. This is our last class in the formal part of the course. We're going to take a month break for Pesach, and then we'll get back together on both Yom Yerushalayim and Yom HaShoah, which both fall out on Monday night, Tuesday's observance, and how they actually fall out. And we'll talk about the different controversies that have been created over the creation of a new day of mourning on Yom HaShoah. And then we'll have a special guest speaker coming in on Yom HaTzmaut the following week. We'll talk about the various controversies that arose during the period in creation of the state. Okay, tonight's class, continuing in the development of the modern state of Israel, the Haganah, the Irgun, and Lehi, fighting for the land. So there are a lot of different names of these warring groups. There's a Haganah, Irgun, Lehi, Palmach. Who did what, and where did they fit in? That's what we're going to talk about tonight. One of the reasons why I want to talk about this is because this was a very difficult and complex stage in Jewish history. We're going to be talking about primarily the late 30s through the 40s, the decade leading up to the creation of the modern-day state of Israel. And it was not simple. And I'd like to express it in the following way. I remember about 13, 14 years ago, I had actually just moved to Atlanta. I remember where I was at the time. There was something going on in Israel, as there usually is. And the Israeli government and army had carried out some operation in which they had killed a number of what we would call Palestinian terrorists. They had gone in. I don't remember the details of it. It doesn't really matter necessarily. It was one of the things, and it was a big deal. And I remember being at the Shabbos table, and the topic of conversation turned to the operation. And it was mentioned, people were celebrating it, so to speak. There wasn't a party going on, but people were speaking in glowing terms about the success of the Israeli army and what they had done, and this, that, and the other. And somebody at the table asked and said, is it so simple that just because it was the Israeli army who carried this out, that it was right? Maybe what they did was wrong. Who says that the actions that they took are correct? From a Jewish perspective, from a halachic perspective, was this operation acceptable? And a very powerful question. Because I personally had sort of grown up with this understanding of we're the defense force, and everything that we do is in defense of our people, and is therefore okay. And every once in a while there's a specific operation that happens, and maybe it's not so simple. And this ties into the discussions we've had over the past 2 weeks of how do we deal with a government in the land of Israel representing the Jewish people that does not actually represent the Torah Jewish people at all. So is this really representative of the Jews? Is this representative of the way the Jews should be? Is this representative of what the Torah wants us to be? It happens to be a secular anti-Torah government. We're talking, not now, we're talking back in the 30s and 40s. So is what they did okay? Are we intrinsically supposed to support it because they're Israelis? So sometimes yes, sometimes no. It's very complex. It's a very interesting question. So what we're going to do tonight is go back to this period. There were various approaches as to how the early Yishuv in the 30s, the 20s, 30s, and the 40s were supposed to handle the situation that they were in. What I want to do, because we're now moving into the 20th century, we actually have footage, we have videos, we have documentaries. So I'd like to show you one. What I'm going to show you tonight is not necessarily the best one about the Irgun and about the Haganah. But it's the only one that I found that was less than 10 minutes. So we're going to go with it.
Why is it not the best?
I'll tell you why. That's why I'm showing you. I want to introduce it as follows. This is not produced from an Israeli perspective. And I'm showing it to you not only because I found that it was less than 10 minutes, I thought it was good. It's a little bit provocative because I want you to watch this and watch this as much as you can with neutral eyes, as if you were an American who did not know Israeli history. Wasn't Jewish. and is trying to get a handle on the conflict that's taking place today. And someone said, well, you need to learn a little bit about what happened. And they showed you this 10-minute clip about some of the events. What we're going to do is we're then going to use this as a springboard. We're going to fill in a lot of the details that are obviously not covered in these 10 minutes. And the hour that we'll have beyond that also won't cover all that we'll need to get to. But watch it with those eyes. And then we'll use this as a springboard to discuss some of the different perspectives that were taken as we I'll dim the lights after we get started. It's a little bit less than 10 minutes. Okay. Pretty interesting, huh? Okay, so we're going to sort of touch on a lot of the things that were mentioned here. I imagine for you, as it is for me, the most difficult part about that is hearing the phrase terrorist, right? Jewish terrorist. And even in the film, what was the response? What did I forgot his name, that fellow's being interviewed. What did he say? No, the Jew who was being interviewed. It wasn't violence, it was a war. I'm fighting for my homeland. My people are drowning at sea. And if my people are drowning at sea, what do you want me to do? There are lives at stake. Now, in as much as they used the word terrorism, that the scholar that was interviewed a couple of times, that young fellow, mentioned that the Irgun never attacked civilians, they only attacked the military installations. But that didn't stop them from referring to them as terrorists. So is there a difference between attacking military personnel when there hasn't been an official war declared? There was no official war in Palestine versus from the Jews versus the British. They're not attacking civilians, they're attacking the British. It was a very complex time. And depending on your perspective, you will evaluate all the things that happened very differently. Begin was the most wanted terrorist in the entire British Empire for acts of what they considered murder. And in the Jewish historians, he was a valiant warrior who really brought about eventual freedom, although not even everybody within the Jewish world agree with that statement. So let's put this in context. Let's put this in context. Thank you very much. All right, let's begin in our notes. So let's start with a little bit of history, a little background, just a little bit to sort of understand that which was taking place. What are the origins of the Haganah? Now, that little clip that we watched pretty much focused on the Irgun. The Irgun was really a small break off of the much larger group, which was the central group, the Jewish agency's primary mode of protection, which was the Haganah. That is the mainstream. And the Irgun is the break off. And hopefully all these terms, for those of you who are not familiar with them, will become much more familiar as we go on. What is the origin of this Haganah? So it really began in the early 1900s as the Jews began returning in significant numbers. The land in the early 1900s was controlled by the Arabs. It was part of the Ottoman Empire. And how long had it been part of the Ottoman Empire? 400 or 500 years, that's exactly. Since the 16th century, the Ottomans were in control. Now this is a fact which is really fascinating when you think about it. If you just be a neutral observer to the turmoil in the Middle East, you would say, whose land is this? It was mentioned on the film. If you're the big and the strong, you can decide to engage or not. If you're the small and the weak, and your existence is at stake, then there are no boundaries. There are no limits. You can do anything. If you're fighting for your land, you'll stop at nothing. If you are a peacekeeper, you're the British, and this is not your land, there are many things that will make you stop and say, this is not worth it. Whose land is it? If you're just asking an objective person. So it's a very tricky thing, because most people would say, well, the Ottoman Turks, the Arabs were there for 500 years. Okay, well, I mean, if you go back 500 years, that's like a long time. And it's double the amount of time that the Americans have been in America, and yet we consider this land ours. Would anyone say this is Native American land anymore? Just a few Native Americans. But the rest of us would say, it's American. It's only, how long is it? Not even 300 years. But there were Arabs. But so from one perspective, you would say, well, they were there. But we look at it from our, we look at it as, well, we were there before that. So who's calling this home?
How can you compare?
How can I? What do you mean? How can I compare it?
To Israel and the United States saying this is our home. It's a whole different thing.
Well, I know, that's my point. In other words, the Jew would say that because we were there first.
Right.
Right. But you have to go back 2,000 years of history to say that we were going back there. So it's not, if people don't do that, they would say it was Ottoman, it was Turkish, it was Arab. I'm not arguing that point. I'm just saying that's what makes it... I know what I'm saying, but the Arab world can't think beyond, like, we were here for 500 years, and who are you to come in here and kick us out? That's why you have a conflict of two people fighting for what they believe is their land, which is a very different conflict. The British come in, and they're in the middle of two people who are willing to die for their land because they think it's their land, and they are from the outside. They have nothing to fight for other than imperial interest, which only goes so far. Okay, but I'm jumping ahead of myself. So the Jews return into Arab land. Where are the British in the early 1900s? Nowhere. This has nothing to do with them. Hashomer is a group that was founded in 1909 to protect the kibbutzim and the farmers of the yeshuv because you needed protection because it was a dangerous. I'm sorry, go. The battery's about to die. Can you grab those small little two little small batteries? So the Arabs were not happy that the Jews were coming back, and they would regularly either riot, attack, pillage the Jewish settlements. And so the Jewish people needed protection, so they founded what was known as Hashomer. This was already back in 1909, and it existed for a number of years as a basic form of protection. 1914, World War I breaks out. Takes a couple of years, 5 years. It's resolved, and the formation of the League of Nations. League of Nations, very noble concept that all the nations of the world are going to get together and somehow maintain the peace. They're going to be together on this. And in 1917, this is towards the end of the war, the famous Balfour Declaration. We already have England, Great Britain's declaration of intent to establish Palestine, which is now already being flooded by Jews, already we discussed for the last couple of weeks. Beginning in the 1850s already, begins the steady flow. We're well over 50, 60,000 Jews by 1860. By 1910, 1915, the numbers of Jews is swelling, and the Balfour Declaration declares the intent to establish a national homeland for the Jewish people, and the League of Nations creates the mandate for Britain to be in charge of the land. This is their first time there. They enter the land in the 1917-1918 area. They kick the Turks out. They defeat them in war. And that's when they enter into the scene. So the British enter in the late stages of World War I, take over the land, and the League of Nations puts them there, keeps them there, and says, you're in charge of the land, and you'll carry forth this mandate to eventually establish a Jewish homeland, which they may or may not have had intentions to do, but they definitely had intention to keep the land as part of the British Empire. That was clear. It was going to be a Jewish homeland controlled by England. Great Britain, that was the intention. The official language, the mandate document formalized, I quoted here from the original, thank you very much, from the original mandate that they were going to administer it until such time as they're able to stand alone. And the mandate document formalized the division of the British Protectorate, Palestine to include a national home for the Jewish people under direct British rule, and Transjordan and Emirates governed semi-autonomously from Britain under the rule of the Hashemite family. How did the Arabs take to this idea of Britain being put in charge with the intent of creating a Jewish homeland? Not so well. Okay, how did the Arabs take to it? Not well. They respond with riots. Riots in 1920, the riots in 1921. The Hashomer, the organization which was founded to protect the Jews, was clearly overmatched by the riots. And what that led to was the formation of the Haganah. It becomes much more centralized, especially by, you know, after the riots of 1929. We're just going to skip through that basic decade, which was not so pleasant. Lots of issues along the way. I'll leave it. And by 1929, there's without much central authority or leadership, you have this Haganah, the Arab riots of 1929, which began over tensions at the Western Wall. It really began with the Mechitza. If you think the problems that we had in the shul in the mechitza here 4 years ago, Rabbi Feldman announced it, when the Jews brought a mechitza to the Kotel in order to allow the Jews to daven, that kicked off a riot. So we have a long tradition of discussions regarding mechitzas kicking off all sorts of problems. Eventually, that riot, which began at the Kotel in 1929, spread to Hebron, the massacre of the yeshiva boys in Hebron. If you go there today, they have an entire museum dedicated to the boys and Jews who were massacred in 29. And that basically created the drastic change in Haganah Zrolam in letter D, if you're following along with me. At that point, in the late 1920s, early 1930s, it becomes a much larger organization, encompassing nearly all of the youth and adults in the Jewish settlements, as well as thousands of members. Like, you became a member of the Haganah because the Jews needed protection from the Arabs at that time. Britain was clearly not interested in protecting the Jews. It acquired foreign arms, began to develop workshops to create hand grenades, simply military equipment, and it transformed from an untrained militia to a capable underground army. While this is taking place, the continuously mounting Arab pressure, who is not happy with what's going on with the Jewish development, now they have an army, they have a militia, the numbers keep coming, so Arab pressure on Britain being sent to that restricts the number of Jewish immigrants entering Palestine. And already here we begin to have restrictions on immigration. The one thing that the Jews have been trying to push to go, even the Turks weren't necessarily keeping that in 1850s and 60s, you can go. And now that Britain is there, and now there are these major restrictions on being able to get in. I mentioned in the class we had on socialism that it was a Jewish agency who was in charge of the number of papers that you can get in, and they were giving it out only to the people whom they wanted. It was a very small, limited number of Jews who were able to immigrate to Palestine during that time. What happens then in 1931 is the first rift. This is where the Irgun is going to break off from the Haganah. The Haganah is now in its infancy. It's been founded in 1920, 1921. It's existed for 10, 11 years. And now, what happens is many of the Haganah fighters objected to the official policy, which was Havlaga, which was restraint. This is simply, as its name implied, Haganah, which means to defend. They were a group whose sole entity was to defend. We need to defend ourselves from the Arabs. We need to defend ourselves from being attacked, from marauding bands of Arabs who come to loot and to pillage whatever it is that we're trying to build. But there were fighters amongst them who said, that's not enough. It's not enough. Fighters had been instructed to only defend communities, but never to initiate counterattacks against the Arab gangs or their communities. And this policy appeared defeatist to many who believe that the best defense is a good offense. Now, I also mentioned when we were discussing the concept of Zionism and the concept of the early socialists and the concept of where do they fit in the Jewish scheme of things, that idea of just defending was, that's old school. That's what the Jews did in Europe for 600-700 years, and how did that end for us? It was bad. Now we're back home, and we're going to create a new Jew who's going to be 6'3" and blonde with blue eyes and a fighter. And part of that was, this is not enough, this idea of just defending ourselves, never being allowed to counterattack, never being allowed to take an initiative. In order to take back our land, we have to take it. Yeah?
Isn't that very Jewish?
Okay, so here's the question. So this is where you get into all different sorts of things. In other words, you're right, 100%. If someone's actually coming to kill you, you have every right to kill them first, without question. That's halacha. So remember the three oaths that we spoke about, that the Jews will not storm like a wall the land of Israel. Well, now again, the fighters weren't necessarily religious, but just from a Jewish perspective, where do we draw the line between going back peacefully and settling, defending ourselves, and beginning a militia to actually attack? Where do we say this is within the realm of the return? It's just complex, which is what we're painting here. I don't have to take sides. It's great controversy in Jewish history. This is just what's going on. So what happens then in 1931 is the more militant elements of the Haganah, led by Zev Jabotinsky, splinter off and form the Irgun Tzava'oi Le'umi, which is known as the National Military Organization, known as the Irgun, or by ETSA, which are the abbreviations, the Irgun Aleph Sadi Lamed. So that's why things are so confused. There's so many different names for each of the organizations trying to keep track of who's what. We're going to refer to them as the Irgun, known as ETSA, again, their abbreviation. So Irgun splits off from the main Haganah. They are the more militant version. They are the Kana'im, we would call them the hotheads from amongst the group. We're not satisfied saying, we're just going to wait for them to attack and defend ourselves. No. We are going to take matters into our own hands and force the issue. Howard Shachar is an American historian. Writes as follows. The policy of the new organization was based squarely on Jabotinsky's teachings. Jabotinsky was a revisionist Zionist. He adjusted, as we'll see in a second, the main Zionist, the socialist, pure socialist Zionist method, and revised that in his teachings, which called for the immediate establishment of the Jewish state. And it was as follows. Every Jew had the right to enter Palestine. Right now, again, there were impositions, there were limitations as to how many Jews can come in. The policy of the organization, every Jew comes home. Only active retaliation would deter the Arabs. Sitting and waiting for them to attack isn't going to do it. You want to stop the attack? We need active retaliation. And number three, only Jewish armed force would ensure the Jewish state. We need an army, we need to be able to be on the offensive, and we need to be militarized in order to be able to have this Jewish state. And again, we're in 1931. We're pre-World War II, pre-state. Jabotinsky created what many of the books, I don't know what exactly the language he used in Hebrew, is the national sport. What was the national Jewish sport? So it became soccer. And in America, we might say it's baseball, it's a national pastime. What was the national sport of the Jews in the early Yishuv? Illegal immigration. That was the sport. How many Jews can you smuggle into the country? How many ships can we get to hit the shores? How can we pass them through land, through sea, through air? You name it. The goal was get Jews out of Europe, bring them in, get past the British blockades and all of their requirements. 1939, the White Papers are passed by the British Empire, which severely restricted Jewish immigration to Palestine. It's 1939. Hitler is just coming to power. The war is about to start. He's been in power. The war is just starting. No one knows yet what lays in store for the Jewish people of Europe. But the British people already, the government, in response to the Arab pressures, passes these white papers, which are going to remain in effect throughout the late 40s. Severely limiting immigration, deeply, they also prevent the Jews from buying land, which deeply angered the Zionist leadership. Now, David Ben-Gurion, who was the chairman of the Jewish Agency, was of course going to become the first prime minister a decade later. So he sets a policy for the Zionist relationship with the British. This is again the mainstream response. The Irgun is the breakoff, the militant breakoff. The mainstream response of the Jewish Agency as follows, quote, "We shall fight the war against Hitler as if there were no white paper. And then we shall fight the white paper as if there were no war." So that the Jewish Agency, basically when the war breaks out in 1939, sides with England and says, if England's fighting Germany, they're our friends. Germans are our enemies. England has become our friend, and there was a truce, so to speak, that was called in the land of Palestine. And they were, as Ben-Gurion says, totally willing to work together with England. We'll fight the Germans as if there were no white paper. But when this war is over, then we're going to fight the white paper. Now, as a response to that, Haganah then builds up the Palmach. Now, Palmach becomes the Haganah's elite strike force, and they organize illegal Jewish immigration. So just to summarize what we have right now, mainstream is the Haganah. They have their own elite strike force, the Palmach, but that's functioning under Haganah leadership. And we have the breakoff, the Irgun, led, which is not yet led by Menachem Begin. That's going to happen in a few years. Meanwhile, over this course of time, there are approximately 100,000 Jews brought back to Palestine, hundreds of ships in what's known as the Aliyah Bet, the second Aliyah, and that all of that was illegal. All of the Jews who descend are illegal immigrants, if you will, so to speak, in our own country. World War II breaks out. When World War II breaks out, the Irgun lays down its arms. The Irgun, which is beginning to, throughout this decade, do all sorts of attacks against British posts, which is already beginning, in order to be able to allow more immigration. They call a truce. In being allowed to fight their shared enemy, the Germans. I want to mention here Lehi. We're not going to talk about them significantly tonight. Lehi, which is known in English as the Stern Gang, was founded by Avraham Stern. So when World War II breaks out, and the Irgun, which we're going to talk more about the Irgun in a second, but they had been, as we saw in the little clip we watched, they'd been attacking British installations, posts, intelligence, police stations. So when the war breaks out in 1939, everybody lays down their arms and they allow England to fight Germany. One group of Jews was so militant that they said, even now we're not going to stop, because if the British aren't allowing Jews in, they're just as much our enemy as the Germans are. And that became known as the Stern Gang, founded by a Jew by the name of Avraham Stern. They became known as the Lehi, which is the Hebrew acronym for their names. They even attempted to ally several times with fascist Italy and Nazi Germany, because they held, again, no one fully grasped the extent of what the Holocaust did, but in the beginning of the war, anything was better than what the British were doing in preventing Jews from being able to get in. And the goal was get Jews here. And that was the Stern Gang. If you're interested in them, you can find lots of stuff on them online. But they were the... this is why it's so confused. Just trying to imagine what's going on right now in the land of Palestine. It's about like three Jews, four opinions. There are 100,000 Jews there, 150, 200,000. It's not like the community hasn't yet exploded. Maybe 300,000. How many Jews are there? And you have the Haganah. You have the Palmach, you have the Irgun, and you have Lehi. All fighting to defend the land. All vying for who is going to be the authority that will be the defenders of the land. And all of this is taking place. And who's in control of the land? The British. But who are the Jews really always afraid of? The Arabs. This is a tricky time in history for the Jews who are living there. Because you have your Arabs who are rioting every other year, the British are preventing you from immigrating, and you have various different groups all functioning with different agendas. As this is taking place in 1943, and we're just moving along because there's so much to talk about, Menachem Begin enters into the scene. Menachem Begin. So do we call him the Irgun terrorist leader or the freedom fighter? So if you just Google, as I did as I was preparing this, Irgun, or Irgun Haganah documentaries, just different things. So most of the hits that you'll get will also have the word terrorist in it, as you saw in the clip. Because in the world at large, Menachem Begin was stamped a terrorist. Born in Poland in 1913, he was born on Shabbat Nachamu, which is just an interesting little tidbit of history. Shabbos Nachamu is a Shabbos which follows Tisha B'Av, the day that we mourn the destruction of the temple. And the following Shabbos, immediately after Tisha B'Av, is Shabbos Nachamu, in which we get comfort and consolation as we begin the process of looking forward towards the redemption. Menachem Begin is born on that Shabbos, and his parents name him Menachem, he who will comfort his people. Just a little interesting tidbit of information. He was, with unusual intellectual capacity, was a tremendous orator, tremendous leader. He was Jewishly educated, and he finished law school at the time in 1935. He was only 22 years old, and he was profoundly affected by his contact. He had personal contact with Zev Jabotinsky, who gave him the idea of faith in the Jewish people and in the return, vision, pride, courage, action, and a burning passion in Jewish destiny. And Menachem Begin is infected with that. And when you read his writings, we're going to read a couple of things that both his writings and his speeches, which are just so beautiful. They're so filled with an understanding of Jewish history, with an understanding of Tanakh, with an understanding that this is the God-given land to the Jewish people. And he was filled with a faith and a passion and a course of action to take that over. So when he was in Poland, he was part of the Betar Youth Movement, which was Jabotinsky's youth movement. He eventually took over the movement in all of Czechoslovakia. He was the leader of the Betar Youth Movement. He was eventually arrested by the Soviet communists as a British agent, which is ironic because he's eventually going to be the most wanted man in all of the empire. But he was originally arrested when he was a young man by the Soviets. He wrote a book called White Knight, and he describes there what his interrogations were like and his intellectual discussions that he would have with his Russian communist buddies. They would discuss all sorts of things, philosophy and communism and socialism and Zionism. And he eventually was freed because Poland made a pact with Russia during World War II in order that the Russians should free all of the Polish citizens, that the Polish citizens should join the Polish army in the battle against Germany. And when Russia declared war on Germany, so Russia freed all of their Polish prisoners to go fight for the Poles against Germany, which was their common enemy. And in that deal, Begin is freed. He does join the Polish army, and when he's released, he immediately gets to Eretz Yisrael, and the first thing he does is he signs up for the Irgun. And he is immediately recognized as a person of capability, and within a year is appointed the chief commander of the Irgun. He's now all of 29 years old, and he is in charge of the Irgun. 1943, when he takes over, the war had turned. Now again, the Irgun had been laying low for the last 2-3 years because the Jewish agency had made a pact that they were going to fight with together with England. Many Jewish soldiers, by the way, actually went overseas and fought for Britain against the Germans. And the Irgun had no activity during this time. And Begin now shows up in 43. The war had turned. The war is in its last year. It was clear at this point that Germany was going to be defeated. It was simply a matter of time. And at this point, the footage and the reality of what is taking place to the Jews throughout Europe is beginning to leak out. It's beginning to be understood, the atrocities. And again, this is a day and age without email, cell phones, so word doesn't travel as fast. But now, 1943, 44, it's beginning to come out. What happened? And I want to read you a quote. If you haven't read this book, you must. Prime Minister's by Yehuda Avner. Fabulous. So the first 40, 50 pages are about this part of Jewish history that we're discussing tonight. It's just excellent. So I want to read you a quote from him. I have it here, and you can follow it inside. I'm on page 2. Meanwhile, newsreels were showing the British Navy intercepting leaking boats of Jewish survivors off the shores of Palestine and turning their back or interning them. Some of the pitiful vessels, searching in vain for safe harbor, went down with their wretched cargo. Is it any wonder that a man of the stuff of Menachem Begin, driven by an inexpressible anguish, burst forth and with more audacity than armory, led his small but well-entrenched Irgun underground army in a perilous revolt against the British in Palestine? To see the sight of Jews on a boat who escaped Europe, turned away from the homeland, was impossible to tolerate. It was unfathomable. The Jews have now been coming back. It's not like we just got there. They've been coming. It's 1943. Jews have been streaming back for almost 100 years at this point. 1850s and 60s are the first Aliyah. Communities have been built. And now, after the atrocities of the Holocaust are becoming clear, and now boats are being turned away, Jews are drowning at sea after making it to Palestine? Says Menachem Begin, never will I sit back in a policy of restraint and watch that happen. It was lunacy to challenge the British in 42 and 43, but he did so with one underground message which he plastered on every single street corner that he could. Still today, the idea of putting up placards and you walk through the streets of Yerushalayim, they're just like signs everywhere. That's an old tradition. This was his one message. As long as the British mandatory barred the gates to suffering Jews desperately needing to immigrate from Europe, Britain would remain the enemy of the Jewish people. Everything, again, we said, is perspective. Who's fighting who? Where is the war? Who started? Says Menachem Begin, you turn Jews away from our land, you are the enemy of the Jewish people. The Haganah said, diplomacy. We need diplomacy. And Begin said, you turn ships of Jews away, you are the enemy of the Jewish people. Quote, this is from his Manifesto of Revolt. Again, in 1943-44, the Irgun had been laying dormant. They hadn't done anything for years. So Jabotinsky had died in 1939-1940. Their next leader had died. There's nobody there. He comes in and he re-energizes with the end of the Holocaust and the boats being turned away, a new policy. We are at the last, this is his quote from him, we are at the bottom of page 2, we are at the last stage of the war. We stand before a historical decision in the fate of generations. There is no longer any armistice between the Jewish people and the British administration in Eretz Yisrael, which hands our brothers over to Hitler. You send my brother back there to Europe, you are my enemy. Our people are at war with the British regime, war to the end. Again, terrorism, war. What do you hear over and over again in his words? My people are dying, we are at war. Our fighting youth will not be deterred by sacrifice, torment, blood and suffering. They will never surrender, nor shall they rest until our days of old are restored, and until our homeland, freedom, sustenance and justice have been secured. This then is our demand, immediate transfer of power to a provisional Jewish government. We shall fight. Every Jew in the homeland shall fight. The God of Israel, the Lord of hosts, is with us. There shall be no retreat, freedom or death. This is not a statement you would have heard from the early socialists in 1905. The Lord of hosts, the God of our fathers, the God of Israel is with us. We will fight. Freedom or death. Ben-Gurion and Begin are the two mortal enemies, so to speak. Ben-Gurion leading, who's a socialist, who's not into any of this type of talk, who believed in diplomacy, who was the leader of the Jewish agency, which was the mainstream agency, says, I have the British ear. They have a mandate to give us a homeland. Patience. Diplomacy. Patience. Diplomacy. And Begin comes in and he starts blowing up trains, blowing up police stations, hanging British soldiers. Operations are carried out by the underground cells. Now, Begin lives underground. All of the Irgun soldiers are underground. Nobody knows who they are. In his book, Yehuda Avner describes how Begin recalled how he was always hiding, switching locations. He dressed up as the yeshiva bacher for many years. And he was in a shul, and he would go to Daf Yomi, it's a part of his cover, I learned in the shir, and how half of his shul, half of his little shtiebel were underground soldiers, and none of them knew who he was, because part of everyone was sworn to secrecy. There were very few full-time Irgun fighters. Most of them had regular jobs, and they just got their operations and did what they needed to do. But they begin to carry out, in the late 1943, 1944, a series of operations. They attack immigration offices simultaneously in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and in Haifa. That follows with attacks on the income tax offices, British intelligence and police headquarters. And they're, again, as we saw in the clip, they targeted specifically the signs of power and leadership of the British authorities in England. The attack on Yom Kippur in 1944 is an interesting story. He recalls it here in the book Prime Minister. What had happened was the British would not allow the shofar to be blown at the Kotel at the end of Yom Kippur because the Arabs threatened to riot, and so the British stopped it. And for a number of years, any Jew who would blow the shofar on Yom Kippur was basically arrested and thrown into jail. So Begin saw this. He gets there in 1943. He sees that's what happens. He says, in 1944, we're not going to let that happen. Rosh Hashanah, 1944, he puts plasters up all over the city of Jerusalem. He says, on Yom Kippur, we're blowing shofar at the wall. And he writes as follows. Any British soldier who tries to stop us will be viewed as a... I just want to give you the exact quote. I have it here. I'm sorry. Here it is. This is a quote. This is what he puts up. Any British policeman disturbing the service at the Western Wall will be regarded as a criminal and punished accordingly. So here you have the British Empire. British Empire is in control of the land, and they say no shofar blowing. Now the Irgun, which is beginning to develop a history, they've blown up a bunch of police stations, train stations, taken out the tax collection agency, put up signs that say, any British soldier who dares stop us on Yom Kippur will be viewed as a criminal and punished accordingly. Criminal lunacy, cried the left-wing Hebrew press, fearful of the innocent casualties at the wall. The rabbinate declares the blowing of the ram's horn is at the close of the fast is a custom. It's not obligatory. No, what are we doing? Let it alone. But every day the signs go up. The Irgun says, any British soldier who stops us will be treated as a criminal and punished accordingly. Came the culmination of Yom Kippur and the end of the Ne'ilah service. And the deepening twilight, the white-clad cantor facing the shadowy blocks of ancient stones, chanted in a voice that swelled and soared, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. And the whole congregation at the end of Ne'ilah, standing at the Kotel 1944, the war has just ended, the Holocaust of destruction, standing at the Kotel, Shema Yisrael. And then three times he trilled, Baruch Shem Kivod, Malchuso Le'olam Va'ed, may the glorious name of His Majesty be forever. Seven times the cantor intones with trembling fervor, Hashem, Hu Ha'elokim, the Lord is God, the Lord is one. And seven times the congregants avow this invocation. And then he concludes with the final words, Oseh Shalom Bimromov, Hu Yaseh Shalom Aleinu, and the sound of the shofar rings out. Rising on tiptoe, arms stiffened, eyes closed, hands trembling in excitement, the boy who had blown the shofar blew again. A sustained, robust, soaring, exalted single blast, reaching the heights of pure perfection. And not a policeman stirred. Fall out, barked the ruddy-faced sergeant to his men. Return to barracks, at the double. L'shana haba b'Yerushalayim habenuya, hollered the crowd. The following day, Begin wrote in his Irgun underground paper, our ancient stones are not silent. They speak of the house that once stood here, of kings who once knelt here in prayer, of prophets and seers who declaimed their message here, of heroes who fell here dying, and how the great flame at once destructive and illuminating was kindled here. This house and this land, with its prophets and kings and fighters, were ours long before the British ever were a nation. Menachem Begin.
And the Arabs didn't respond.
Not, no. At that moment, on Motzei Yom Kippur, there were four attacks by the Irgun on British headquarters elsewhere in the land. The whole thing was a distraction. There were no Irgun fighters at the actual Kotel. They were carrying out their missions in four other locations at that time. But that scene at the Kotel, it's indescribable. His writing, Yehuda Avner, is just a beautiful, beautiful writer. Where am I? Okay. I was on my way to move to Turkey, so that's where I was. I'm sorry. I just realized I'm still in Atlanta. So disappointing. Yeah, okay. So Begin becomes the most wanted man in the entire British Empire. And as we saw, he's known as a terrorist and as a murderer. The British strike back, publicly flogging, hanging Irgun fighters they captured, and some were not with regular protocol. They were done very hastily, they were done secretively, and so now the British, they're not going to take this lying down, as they begin capturing whoever they can and killing or publicly flogging. And Begin responds, flogging for flogging, hanging for hanging. This is war, he says. You hang our boys, we will hang yours. And that's what we saw. So the picture of the two British sergeants who had been captured hanging in an orange grove. which drove the British nuts. Can you imagine this small little ragtag group of Jews in Palestine capture two sergeants and hang them? It drew their ire. Let me, if I have it here, yeah. We recognize, Begin wrote, no one-sided laws of war. Again, he always talks war. If the British are determined that their way out of the country should be lined with the avenue of gallows and of weeping fathers, mothers, wives, and sweethearts, we shall see to it that, in this case, there shall be no racial discrimination. The gallows will not be all of one color. The price will be paid in full. This began what became known as the hunting season. Again, we're in late 1944. The hunting season was carried out by the Haganah, the Jewish agency, because what they saw happening here was a destruction of their entire process. The Jewish agency represents the official Jewish, they weren't yet a governing body, but they are with the British. And right now, this underground ragtag group that maybe numbered 1,000 people is wreaking havoc in the land. And so the Haganah begins, it's what became known as the hunting season, in which they carry out a well-executed, an all-encompassing plan to turn over Irgun members to the British authorities. I quoted for you here on page 3 their official announcement. This was the official announcement from the Histadrut Council. The perpetrators of terror who call themselves the Irgun and the Lehi are traitors. They must be removed from our classrooms, banished from our workshops. Again, I'm talking, there were controversies here. These are the two Jewish groups who both believe that what? We are going to create a Jewish homeland. And if you don't do it this way, it won't happen. Their propaganda, whether written or spoken, must not be permitted. No refuge must be given to these malefactors in the homes of your parents, relatives, or acquaintances. The incorrigible despoilers must be isolated and abandoned until they are spewed out of the ranks of the Yishuv, until terror ceases and its organization is eradicated. The Jewish agency proposes herewith that all persons who are acquainted with any of the terrorists, again, this is what they refer to in the clip, that the Jews themselves refer to the Irgun as terrorists, should immediately inform the police by word of mouth, in writing, or by telephone, and observe the injunction, listen to this, and thou shalt root out the evil from thy midst. What's that a quote from? Chumash. So the Haganah, in putting out the word to say, you must turn them over, saying, they're terrorists. They're murderers. You are obligated by Torah law to turn them over to the British authorities so that violence will cease in the land. That sounds nice. You talk about a controversy. What side do you join if you're living in Palestine at this day and age? Listen to them. They continue. Fathers who have sons in these organizations should in the same fashion inform the police and observe thereby the injunction, if a man have a stubborn and rebellious son, he must take him out to the elders and say to them, this our son is stubborn and rebellious, he will not obey our voice. All the men of the city shall stone him with stones. Where's that from? Ben Sorer Umorer, right out of the Chumash, a father and a mother take their child to Beis Din and say, we have a wayward son, and they bring him to be stoned, so that the Haganah invokes the Chumash, because if you can imagine, you think the Irgun was filled with 20-year-olds or 40-year-olds? 20s. How old are their parents? 40. Which group are the parents part of? The Haganah. You know, every generation worries about the rebellious teenager. The question is always, what are they rebelling at? If you've been sitting in this room over the last couple of years, we've gone through all the different things, from idolatry in the times of Tanakh, that's what you were afraid of, to socialism, a couple of weeks ago we spoke about, to joining the Irgun, and becoming a terrorist. And as a mother, you lay awake at night in bed, worried that your son was going to be captured by the British and would be in the newspaper hanging from an orange tree.
And there were plenty who were orphans. They made it out of here.
Correct. So now some of the 20-year-olds, they didn't have, right, these are the 20-year-olds who don't have any parents. They come straight out of Europe and they're like, I'll fight and do anything. But here you have the Haganah imploring parents, get your sons out. And if you can't, turn them over to the British. And listen to the last couple of lines. Particularly since the English do not intend to do the terrorists any harm, they will hold them for a year or two apart from other people until their surplus energy, which apparently results from overeating and from inactivity and sloth, has cooled down. It is time to act for the sake of the Jewish people and the homeland. Isn't it amazing? Now again, the Irgun are putting out pamphlets, it's time for the homeland, our Jewish brethren are dying. The Haganah is saying, we're all going to die, the English are going to attack us, stop with the terror and the violence, and allow diplomacy to take its course. Who's right? Great question, right? Nearly 1,200 Irgun fighters are turned over during this period. It's about a 6-7 month period. It's what's known again as the hunting season, by Jews to the British authorities. Begin prevented a civil war. Twice he'd prevent a civil war. This is the first time. He insists that none of his fighters strike back and exercise only restraint. The civil war he held, number one, would have ended the revolt against the British. If the Irgun and Haganah end up in a civil war, so forget about it. Our objective is to free the land of Palestine, not to fight fellow Jews. And number two, he believed that the Haganah would change its course, which he was right about. Because, we're in the late 1940s, 1944. By 1945, the war has ended, and Britain has new elections for a new government, and the Labour Party in England runs on a policy of removing the white papers and abolishing them, and they win a landslide victory, and the first thing they do is take back their promise to do anything about the white papers, and they leave them where they are. 1945, Jews can't go to Palestine. The white papers were the policy that the English had put into place severely limiting Jewish immigration to the land of Palestine. That was put in place in 1939 again. It's now 1945. Much has happened in the world since 1939. 6 million Jews are slaughtered. The rest have nowhere to go, and England will still not allow the Jews to come back. At that point, the Haganah says, we're done. From October, that's in June of 1945 when the elections in England take place. In October, the three forces join together. Lehi, the Irgun, and the Haganah join, and there's a period of about 11 months where all three units are actually fighting together in a group known as the United Resistance. They carry out about 11 missions before disbanding in 1946. They hit train stations. They have like the night of the train stations. They hit 25 different train stations throughout the land of Palestine. They took out bridges, police stations, and various coordinated attacks during that period of time. Okay, what happens is, moving along, what's known as the Black Sabbath, to the British is known as Operation Agatha. This is in June of 1946. In June of 1946, now that, we're skipping through a lot of things just to get everything in that I want to get in. So again, in October of 1946, the three forces joined together and they carried a number of initiatives. Now again, that's very demoralizing to the British. This is a problem. There are train stations and bridges being blown up left and right. So what they do to clamp down is they unleash Operation Agatha, which is in, of June now of 1946, in which somewhere between the numbers range between 10,000 and 25,000. So I went with the middle number of 17,000, which is also quoted. Flood the country, 17,000 soldiers, and they arrest 2,700 Jews. They confiscate weapons and significant information and papers. I want to just stress what that means. They raid, basically, almost all of the Irgun, Lehi, and Haganah offices, arresting 2,700 people. And this is not a large army of Jews. 2,700, it was a significant number. And I don't say most importantly, but very significantly, the papers that they confiscated were almost all of their plans and then implicated, you know, a ton of other Jews as far as what would be considered traitorous behaviors, all sorts of memos and things, and that all was being stored in the, their police headquarters, in the army headquarters, which was in the King David Hotel. So the King David Hotel was not only chosen because it was the center nerve of the British authorities' presence in the land of Israel, but it also contained a ton of incriminating evidence against them. So that what is skipped over and the clip that we saw was it wasn't just that the Irgun chose that hotel, that was at the end of this series of cascading events in which the Irgun would attack, the British would counterattack, the Irgun would attack, after the Black Sabbath, the reason I call Black Sabbath because it was on a Shabbos where they came in and they arrested all of these Jews. In response to that, the United Resistance authorized the attack on the King David Hotel. It was a joint attack, but it was carried out by the Irgun, and as we saw, how they had scouted it out. They figured out a way to be able to get in by dressing up as Arabs and pretending to be the milk delivery guys, which happened every day anyway. It is historically, at this point, proven, the clip notwithstanding, that a warning was given. They have records of it. The operator who testified at the inquiry testified to the fact that she had received the warning, and there were a number of miscommunications. I think the bottom line is, even with the warning, you basically had 22 to 30 minutes to evacuate an entire hotel. It was unclear whether or not the warning was valid or not. It wasn't the only warning that they ever got. And there was not a clear process in place for them to somehow alert everyone. So despite the fact the warning was given, the reality was almost nothing was done. The French embassy, which was next door, opened up all their windows, which was the warning that they had gotten, which was a further historical proof that the warning had come in. It's clear that the warning had come in, and it's also clear that they didn't know what to do with it or how to deal with it, so it ended up being ineffective. At the end of the day, as was mentioned, 91 people die in the blast, 47 Arabs, about 20 or so Brits, and 17 Jews die in that particular attack, and that was the deadliest single attack until that point, and it is identified as the first worldwide terrorist act post-World War II. That's not a good distinction to have. That set things off. As was mentioned in the clip, the England did not respond in any way lightly to that, clamping down, and things continued to disintegrate. What happened after that, Ben-Gurion, who happened to have been in France at the time, even though it had been a joint mission, distanced himself from it, declared the Irgun to be the enemy of the Jewish people, and that was the disbanding of the group. They had functioned again since October of the previous year of 1945 as a unified front. It disbanded after that. We're now into 1946, 1947, and by this point, the rest is almost history. In 1947, the UN, England basically gives up in 1947. They've had enough, and that goes back to the basic reality of this is not England's land. They don't have any claim to it. They don't want it other than for imperial reasons. The war bankrupted them. They were still licking their wounds. They didn't need this. You have Arabs constantly riding, which we haven't focused on, but that's what's going on regularly. The Jews are bombing their train stations, their railroads, their police headquarters, hanging their boys. It was just a disaster of a situation as far as that goes as well. So they handed the problem back to the UN, which had given them the problem in the form of the General Assembly, the League of Nations, 40 years before, and said, here, you take this land and create the Jewish homeland. England gave it back and said, you deal with it. We're done. 1947, the UN agrees to do so. The mandate would end the following year on May 15th of 1948. And that is when Ben-Gurion declares independence. Two things that I want to share with you as we, maybe three, depending on how we do it time-wise. What I printed out for you on the back of your sheet, beginning on page, what is that, four, is Begin's speech on the night that independence is declared. It is a magnificent speech. What he does in this speech, I gave it, we're not going to read the whole thing, obviously, because it's way too long. It'll take you 2 minutes to read through. What he does is he basically declares the end of the Irgun. Menachem Begin, who's been fighting with the Irgun for since 1943 when he arrived, after 5 years of living underground, declares, this is the fulfillment of our dream. I have argued with Ben-Gurion from the moment I stepped into this land as to how to get to this point. Ben-Gurion held Diplomacy and patience, diplomacy and patience. And I have held, we have to fight. We have to attack. Our Jewish brethren are dying. They're being kept out of the land. And we cannot sit still. This is a war. We will not rest until every Jew has a place to go. And we've clashed for 5 years as to how to accomplish that goal. But now that the goal has been accomplished, tonight we lay down our weapons and join the government. Because there is only going to be one Jewish government. And now that it is a Jewish land in Jewish hands, and it is clear that it's a Jewish agency which has been given the authority to rule the land, we're done. And he declared to his Irgun fighters, you have to read the speech, it's truly magnificent, that the Jewish people have succeeded in our mission and our fighting amongst ourselves, and in attacking the Rish is finished. It was unclear whether or not everybody believed him or not. This is a pretty noble speech to make. I mean, we talk about in American democracy when the leader who loses the election calls to congratulate the victor. This is much more significant. And in the night of the independence, you get that, I underlined that one line on page 7, the Irgun Tzvi Lu'umi, the Irgun is leaving the underground inside the boundaries of the Hebrew independent state. We went underground, just one paragraph, we went underground, we arose in the underground, under a rule of oppression in order to strike at oppression and to overthrow it. And right well have we struck. Now, for the time being, we have a Hebrew rule in part of our homeland, because the partition plan was only going to give them part of the homeland. And in this part, there will be Hebrew law. And that is the only rightful law in this country. There is no need for a Hebrew underground. In the state of Israel, we shall be soldiers and builders. And we shall respect its government, for it is our government. We expect that this provisional government and every other government will take care not to surrender to external elements or act in tyranny against internal bodies. The government must protect human and civil rights without discrimination and favoritism. It shall safeguard the principles of justice and freedom, and our house shall shine with fraternity and brotherly love. It's a beautiful speech. What happens is, this is May of 1948. Until May of 1948, the Irgun and the Haganah are still at odds because they had split after the bombing of the King David Hotel a year earlier. The Irgun had arranged a ship that was going to leave from Italy carrying about 950 Irgun soldiers who had escaped the war in England and a ton of ammunition and arms, and was going to leave to rearm the Irgun in the land of Israel. But there were delays, and before it eventually disembarked from Italy, the state is declared independent, and the Irgun says, we're done. It arrives in Israel in June, less than 4 weeks after this big speech, which was a very murky period of transferring power from the Irgun to what became the Haganah, becomes, of course, the IDF, Israeli Defense Forces. It becomes the one army of the Jewish people. But these things take time until you fully transfer it. Into that very murky, unclear period of transfer, this ship arrives with 950 Irgun soldiers and a ton of ammunition. Whose ship is it? So it was purely arranged by the Irgun. There was no doubt about that. But now, since it left, it's like a Gemara question. If I left the poor, then I belong to the Irgun. I arrive in Israel, and now who gets control of it? Well, it was not so simple. And there was if you're interested in this story, the Altalina was the name of the ship. I'm sure you've all heard of it. There are two full-length movies about it, and books, and books, and books. We're not going to get into it right now. The point of our getting is only in the context of our great Jewish controversy. It was not clear that Begin meant what he said, or that the Irgun fighters would follow him. So that in the early weeks of May and June of 1948, the potential for an uprising from within the Jewish people, from the Irgun leadership against the newly formed government of the Jewish Agency, the Haganah, which now became the IDF, was real. Who's in control? And this ship arrives. Without getting into all the details, which are fascinating if you want to look into it, hits the port. Some people get out, some people are still in, the arms are still in, they don't land on board, they decide to travel onward. There's a lot of dialogue between Ben-Gurion and Begin as to what to do with it. What was said, what was not said, it becomes unclear. At the end of the day, literal firefights break out between Irgun soldiers on the beach and Haganah soldiers on the beach. Haganah forces fire and shell the ship. Begin was literally on the ship or heading towards the ship at the time, and the ship eventually, most of it goes down. It sunk on purpose a little bit later, but I forget the exact numbers. 17, 25, bunch of Jews are killed by Jews. There were all these stories of the Jews who refused to take part, the Jews who did. It was one of the great debacles in the early weeks of the state. And I mention it because the country was on the cusp of a civil war. This event, I'm not really doing it justice because it's much bigger than the time that we have, literally pitted the Irgun soldiers who are just a few weeks from hearing their leader say, "We're done," from the Haganah, newly formed IDF. They've literally killed each other. They've shelled a ship. And the entire country was on the cusp of total civil war, and Begin prevents it for the second time in his life, and he makes strong statements that a Jew will not fight against a Jew. We did not go through 2,000 years of exile to culminate in the Holocaust, to create our own homeland, to fire upon fellow Jews. And he is credited with diffusing the situation from the Altalena, which could have easily exploded, as he did during the hunting season, and refused to allow Jew to attack another Jew, and eventually the situation diffused. It has remained in Israeli politics, folklore, history as a seminal event. As I mentioned, there are two full-length films on it. There are books that have been written about it. If you want just a briefer synopsis, you can go to Wikipedia, and it has maybe like 5 minutes worth of reading, so you don't have to read an entire book. But on all of the details, the back and forth, the conversations, the miscommunications, all that went into it. But once again, Menachem Begin refused. And as the film pointed out, with a sense of irony, but from a Jewish perspective, it's not ironic at all. What does Begin become when he's the leader of the minority element of the government? The labor, led by the socialists, led by Ben-Gurion, are in control of the Israeli government from 1948 all the way, I think it's until, is it 76 when Begin wins? Is that in that area? Somewhere around there? I don't remember. And so for the first 30 years, it's a labor-dominated government until Begin finally takes over. He's an older man already at that point. And he becomes the peace seeker. So in the clip you saw, that was like the irony that the Jewish terrorist becomes. But that's a skewed perspective. What's our perspective on that? This is a man who says, "My brethren are being killed, and you're not letting them come home and are allowing them to drown at sea. We will fight for our freedom. This is our homeland. When we have our homeland, I'm all for peace." There is no peace to be had because our Arab cousins believe that it's their homeland, and for various other reasons. But what we've engaged in, what the world, I won't say the world hasn't seen before, because I'm sure it has, what is taking place in the Middle East is not a battle in which England will eventually get out, because they don't have an interest. Whatever imperial interest we have doesn't compare with what we're dealing with, so we leave. But the Jews, we're here to stay. This is our homeland. And our cousins have similar sentiments. That's why we're locked in a battle that none of us can see the end of anytime soon. But so the Ribbono Shel Olam runs the world, and he will eventually show us when we'll be able to be in control of our entire land and live in peace and in harmony. But that's hopefully happening in the near future, Mirtzah Hashem. But in any case, what I wanted to share with you tonight, and I hope I did justice to, because the topic is much bigger than the time that we had, was some of the different parties and infighting within the Jews in the early years, and the two vastly different approaches, and the hawkish and dovish approaches that existed in the 30s and 40s, is until today, do we take the land with force? Do we take the land with fighting and with violence and with initiating? Or do we take the approach of diplomacy and patience and diplomacy and patience? The concluding line in the film we saw was, it was diplomacy which won out in the end, but there's no question that it was moved along by the violence of the Irgun. Who's right? Who's wrong? I'm not here to decide. I am here to tell you, read this book. That's what I'm here to tell you. Stories are fascinating, uplifting, and inspiring. Lashana haba Yerushalayim. To hear the shofar at the hotel. All right, questions, comments?
I couldn't talk about Ryan Weinfeld, the role that he played in the...
No. Not yet. So again, we're off. I believe it's 4 full weeks. I don't have the calendar in front of me. But I think the next class is April... April 28th, after Pesach, and that will be on Yom HaShoah, commemorating the Holocaust. And then the week after that, we have a special guest speaker from Israel, who will be speaking about Yom HaAtzmaut and the two controversies that both of these days created in the modern world in which we live in. All right, everyone, have a wonderful evening. We'll get back together in about a month.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.